You know, Christians have this had an amazing way of smiling lovingly at you while telling you that you're going to go to hell.
He would dedicate most of his weekends with us kids. I don't know, he's the father. The father's always the fun one, right?
You have to wonder if something else is at play when we're trying to find a place in a very short amount of time and then something a bit magical happens.
You're listening to All the Best, a storytelling and documentary show every week bringing you new stories from young people around Australia. Maddie Stutchbury opens this week's episode with a little insight into sibling politics.
There are three kids in my family. There's me, my brother, and my sister. Close in age, but we're not really close in friendship. When we were little, the three of us came up with this neat little system to differentiate between the three of us when speaking to our mother or other family members. My brother and I, the two eldest, are known as the big guys, and my little sister and my brother are the little guys. The little guys have always been closer than the big guys, not in age, but emotionally. This own little club that I was never invited to. And it was just simple things like insider jokes they would never clue me in on, practical jokes, simple imitations of my voice and my manner, kid stuff. They didn't pick on me, but sometimes they excluded me. This club of two, this world of the little guys, it never expanded to include me. These two creatures were so like me. My sister and I share the same stubbornness and bright curiosity. My brother and I have the same eyes, the same laugh. But when we sat together, they just disappeared into their own world. I would look at the back of their glossy heads, tucked neatly together in a row as they bent over a toy or shared a joke together. I was never in on the joke, always just watching. There were two groups though. I mean, there were the little guys, and then there were the big guys. It wasn't until we were on our own, my brother and I, did the big guys come into their own. See, we were the two eldest. When my sister grew older and suddenly became a girl, I remember my brother and I would take it in turns to hide her Shannon Knoll CD just to see her cry. Even though my brother was both a big guy and a little guy, it was pretty clear that he much preferred his pairing with my sister and not with me. I thought that we would grow out of it, but we never really did. Even now, my brother travels a lot, he doesn't come home much, and my sister, she studies really hard. They don't see each other often. Yet in spite of this, whenever they are together, they cease to be two individuals. They once more are the little guys. And the years slip away as the muffled laughter between them intensifies. I try not to let it bother me. I'm an adult. We all are. But even if it does upset me, I can't let it show because I'm the eldest. I'm the big guy.
In jokes, classroom cliques, and family secrets, how much does it suck to feel like you're on the outside? This week we've got stories about being in on it, because either you are or you aren't. If you are, you might be oblivious to the people on the outside, like the little guys in Maddie's story, or maybe you're well aware. But under stranger circumstances, you might find yourself in on something you didn't even know you were a part of. What happens when a writer uses his own family for material in a script to be performed in front of a live audience? And what if the family member in question is hearing it for the first time in public? Imagine sitting in the audience and discovering that you're the subject of a fictional piece which mines your life for material. Our first story was made with Little Fictions, a monthly showpiece of short Australian drama in Sydney. But as we learn in this story, fiction has to come from somewhere, and the truth is often buried deep inside.
This is the father.
If you aspire to be a writer, you soon realise that it's all about the material, and then you begin to ruthlessly cannibalise everything and anything around you. You will filch, you will absorb other people's life stories and attempt to filter them and adopt them.
This is the son.
It was bound to happen eventually. He's kind of gone through every other family member, so I knew my time was coming. Yeah.
This is the actor.
There was no single defining moment where it hit me out of a clear blue sky like one of those falling anvils in the cartoons. No, it was more a series of small moments that, to an outsider, might look kind of cliched, but I can't help that.
This is the producer.
Little Fictions is a live show where actors read short Australian stories. I was particularly keen that the show, which is called I Heart LGBTQI, the MC, the actors and the authors would be represented from the queer community.
At 6 years old, my father wants to sign me up to play soccer with our local team. Every Saturday morning, my body is more or less present on the soccer field. On one memorable occasion, alerted by the shouting of the excitable man who is our coach, I look down to discover that the ball has rolled to a stop next to me. At this point, I become acutely aware that a swarm of seven-year-olds is bearing down on me with madness in their eyes and murder in their heart. I kick it. The ball somehow goes in. I have scored. Wow. I have scored in my own net. Oops.
I remember it vividly. I remember really being against the idea, but I was bribed, so it was worth it. I remember them being on the side of the field, and as I ran one way, they would also run alongside with me, and just having absolutely no idea what I was doing. No idea.
So the first thing to note about the soccer incident was that it didn't happen like that. It was obviously exaggerated, hopefully for comedic effect. His coach was a psychotic parent who believed what was going on the field had great seriousness.
And so I was probably a bit of a letdown. Disappointment. Soccer disappointment.
At 10 years old, the year of the Spice Girls. Posh, ginger, sporty, baby and scary. The endlessly wonderful Spice Girls sweep into my life via my sisters. Together with her friends, she forms a kind of tribute act incorporating makeup, costumes, dance moves. They learn all the lyrics to Wannabe and want to perform the song every day during school lunch break. My sister is Posh Spice, which makes her almost famous at our school. I bask in reflected glory. I am almost famous once removed, which makes me not quite almost famous. I was a wannabe Spice Girl.
If you wanna be my lover, you gotta get... That's the only part of the story where nothing is made up whatsoever. That is exactly as it was. Like, it wasn't just his sister, it was, she was almost a Spice Girl. Taking it too easy, but that's the way it is. What you think about that? Now you know how I feel.
Say you can handle my love. At 17 years old, Friday night is church fellowship night. I like Christians. Robert, the youth minister, asks each of us to share something about ourselves we might like the group to pray about. I stand up and reveal my secret identity like Clark Kent whipping off the spectacles. Surprise! I'm gay! The smiles slip away. There is silence. The ambience is no longer warm or inclusive. At this point, I notice Robert, the youth minister, is staring at me like the Dark Lord of Beelzebub has materialized amongst the church flock. Robert coldly thanks me for my contribution and moves on to the next person. I notice that he forgets to pray for me. The next day, Robert sends me a text message suggesting I might like to find another fellowship group to attend.
I dramatized it by bringing it into a location and a moment where it all came together, the church authorities, his friends and him. That didn't happen that way. It was clear to him from everything he'd learned at the church and at the fellowship, you know, homosexuality was considered a sin, and, you know, Christians have this had an amazing way of smiling lovingly at you while telling you that you're going to go to hell. And then we got in the post a Christian handbook of how to deal with the psychological, physiological problem that was homosexuality. This book indicated that it was basically a problem of the adolescent's relationship with the father. And the father must have been cold and remote.
He was definitely the favorite parent, and it was very exciting when he was around. He would dedicate most of his weekends with us kids. I don't know, he's the father. The father's always the fun one, right? I have always had a very supportive family and a very close family.
Most of his family who were at the performance that night, I think it could be truly said that story came from a place of insight and sensitivity, which is, after all, the kind of idea that I wanted to express.
One of the things I didn't realise about the Little Fictions experience in its entirety is that when you write something that's performed there and recorded, it attains a life of its own. And you have to be aware of that. You may find it turns up, you know, in months to come in a different context, a different part of the country even. The question is, am I cannibalizing my son's life story for my own purposes? And in doing so, I'm editing, I'm controlling the narrative, I'm co-opting his story.
You don't want your story written and put on the internet. That's my life now.
Is that ethical? You know, is there a moral compass that should be brought to bear in all this? And then comes the second aspect, which is the cultural appropriation question. Is it right for me to write the story in the first person as if I am the young gay boy who's gone through all this?
It was mentioned in an article after the event, and it's got my name, and it mentions that I was, you know, hearing it for the first time that night. I didn't expect any of that to happen. He didn't ask for permission or anything. All of a sudden, yeah, it's there on the internet with my name.
One of the great things about the skill and practice of writing fiction, is that you can write from within the shoes, from the point of view of somebody who is not you.
I feel like the story ended, like, really the beginning of my life. I was only just becoming, like, a person and knowing who I was and having a strong character. So, no, it has not shaped me in any way. I'd like to be involved next time, more involved next time. I think the two of us could work well together.
The gist of the story is that sexuality is relatively trivial. And in terms of our humanity, it's actually, it's a powerful chemical impulse, but it should be considered on a lower rung by far to more uplifting aspects of our humanity.
I appreciate what my dad has done in writing this story. I think it's cool that now I have something physical that I could hold on to forever.
That story was by Neil Ashworth, read by actor Mark James Desai, and recorded by Little Fictions. When you move into a rental property, you don't always think much about the people who live there before you. There might be a few signs of life left over, like an overgrown vegetable garden, or maybe an odd stool or a mug left behind in the kitchen, or a name engraved in the concrete outside. But most of the time, you don't think about the possibility that you may be connected in more ways than one. In our next story, Andy moves into a share house and gets let in on a little bit of history they never expected to find. Sam Johncher brings us this one. Just a heads up, this story has some bad language.
Andy, Katie, and their housemates have been living in Dulwich Hill in a share house for 2 years when it happened.
Had a sleep in, got in the shower, and I'm just sort of getting out, wet, naked, wrapping a towel around me. And then another housemate has in his hand the 30-day notice of eviction that he's just brought from the front. I just remember, like, sitting on my bed and crying.
You must leave now, take what you need, you think will last. But whatever you wish to keep, you'd better grab it fair.
Andy, Katie, and their three housemates loved their home in Dulwich Hill. They'd called it by its name, Daytona, which they literally took from a plaque glued to the front brick face. They'd carefully cultivated a veggie patch in the backyard and built a compost bay. Andy kept chickens and had built them a coop. They had friends that lived all around them, they had routines, a local grocer, they knew the bus routes. Through thick and thin, Daytona was their rock. Then, suddenly, with no way to repeal the decision, they had just 4 weeks to find a new house. That sounds easy enough, but in Sydney's inner west, there aren't that many options for five students on a budget who need to live close to uni.
It was amazing how much the rental market's changed, even in the few years that I've been a student. It used to be, like, not necessarily easy, but, like, possible to find, like, houses in the inner west for no more than 150 a room. But it was just really hard this time. Like, there was just fuck all.
Take what you have gathered from coincidence.
We looked at another place in Marrickville, which was around the same price and, like, great location and everything, but there was significant mold in the bedrooms. And it's just like, you just have to ask that question of, like, how is this legal to rent that out to people?
Moving house is always hard. Moving house as a student in Sydney is extremely hard. Landlords are suspicious, prices are too high, competition is fierce. Andy, Katie, and their housemates spent the better part of 3 weeks putting their studies on hold, going to inspections, and dismantling the life that they'd made for themselves at Daytona.
And it's all over now, baby blue.
Yeah, I guess the thing that makes me angry as well is the sense of powerlessness or whatever as well in it. Because if landlords want to do what they want to do with their property, like, I guess that's their prerogative at the end of the day. But it just would have been really nice to have some kind of human conversation about that.
With only a few days left before the eviction date, a house in Concord offered them a lease. It was further away from Sydney Uni than they were hoping for, but with five bedrooms at $800 a week, it was too good a deal to pass up.
We just applied like you would to any other normal house. Like, I think we applied for like three. And we just found out, like, you know, we just got this phone call saying, like, you got approved for the house. And we're like, mad. And then I rang my dad to tell him about it. And then he was like, oh, which one was it? And I was like, oh, it was the one in Concord. And he was like, oh, cool, what's the address? And then I told him and he was like, are you fucking kidding me?
Turns out Andy was about to get more of a human connection than they'd bargained for.
Like, your grandpa was born in that house. Literally the same house. They all just lost their shit. It was hilarious.
Andy's great-grandparents built the house that Andy and their housemates were now renting. They bought it from the builder in 1921, raised four children there, and then sold it in 1967.
Um, Yeah, here's that photo I was talking about before. So that, so this in the photo is Concord Road, and there's like literally like horse and carts on there, like in 1918. So they've just finished clearing all of it. And the caption says, land has been cleared and roads made, ready for subdivision, but large-scale suburban development has not yet taken place. So you can sort of see there's Concord Road sort of running kind of halfway up the sort of hill sort of thing, and then these sort of regular lines running down are the roads that now are all the suburban streets. So I don't know which one's which or anything.
But that's crazy. Like, that's 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Andy's great-grandparents, Cecil and Eileen, were newlyweds when they bought the house in Concord. Cecil had fought in World War I, which made him eligible for government financial support. The soldier settlement scheme, that's what made their purchase of the land and construction of the house possible.
And so, yeah, and before this, all of this was dairy farms. And like my, when I was talking to my dad about it, he said that Bron was like having a go at them being like, oh, that's like, you know, the bush and so far away and like all that sort of stuff. Because like this used to be like the end of Sydney, you know?
Because now it's the affordable place to live.
Yeah. And it's also like, if you look at a map of Sydney, like we kind of, we're all like, oh my God, we're moving out of the inner west and like we're so far away. And it's just like, no, no, you're not. What else do we have?
Oh, it's the title deed.
Oh, it's the deed. Jesus. All right.
Andy's great-grandmother Eileen sold the house to its new owners, Giuseppe and Maria Leviano, in 1967. That was the last they'd seen of their home.
And then after Cecil died, like, I think, you know, it was a bit too much for Eileen, trying to keep up the whole place by herself and, you know, and emotionally and everything else. So then she sold it so she could move into a nursing home that was closer to one of the boys in like
she moved to a nursing home in Sydney's West, close to her children. With the family house sold, they could afford her nursing home.
If you look at the path, like I don't. Yeah, yeah. So this is the backyard. So the current owners are like 90-year-old Italians. So I think it's this like mixture of like, you know, 1920s Irish, you know, ness with like 50 years of Italians being here. You know, like a shed.
Giuseppe
well,
Leviano is now 90 years old. There, Maria, now 80.
We haven't been doing that. We're just
they lived in the house for nearly 50 years. Know, they raised their children there and made the house their home. They only moved out in December of last year. Like Cecil and Eileen, the Levianos lived in the house until they no longer could. Now Andy, Katie, and their housemates are the very first tenants.
Just like bits of wire on random, like, if you look at the part.
Like Andy's grandfather, Joe Leviano also grew up in the house, but at a different time. He was 5 years old when his family moved in. Joe and I spoke on the phone about this unusual situation.
I guess it was his grandmother who we bought the house off. And I do remember her vividly. I was only 5 years old, but I do remember going to the house and seeing her in the kitchen. And we bought the house off her. And my whole childhood was there. Basically, I spent 45 years of my life, or 40 years of my life there. And my parents have loved that house. It's been there for now for 50-odd years, and it's great. It's a great house. Your dad's always taken care of it, you know, and it's still as solid as it was from day one.
Yeah, wow. Is it kind of weird having tenants in there now?
It was. I'll be honest with you. We needed the money to put both parents in a nursing home, so there was a contemplation of actually selling the house, which is worth a bit of money, or we're putting renters in there. Dad paid peanuts for the house in 1967. Now it's worth, you know, well over $2.5 million. And then the real estate agent came to us and said, look, we've got 5 university students. And I said, you know what, university students, we're not too sure. A 5-bedroom, 6-bedroom house. There was a number of people looking for it. And one person actually offered more. And my dad said, listen, if we don't give the young ones a go, no one's going to give them a go, especially university students, because everyone shies away from university students. So my dad actually was the one who actually said, you know what, give them a go.
Oh, that's so sweet.
On the 23rd of May, 1921, Cecil and Eileen bought their first and only home. Over the next 46 years, they would raise 4 children under its roof. Now, almost 97 years later, to the day, Cecil and Eileen's great-grandchild is back living under that same roof. Andy and their housemates are still settling in. The chickens that Annie keeps are still being babysit by a friend, and the backyard still needs a bit of work to get it ready for vegetables. But they hope that, unlike Daytona, this new house will see them through the rest of their degrees.
It's interesting, because if the home was kept in the family, it could have ended up that we might have ended up renting it anyway, especially when we were in quite a sticky situation where we had 30 days to find a new place. But you sort of have to, you have to wonder if something else is at play when we're trying to find a place in a very short amount of time, and then something a bit magical happens where we end up living in one of the housemates' grandparents' family home.
The house really is lovely. 5 bedrooms, 3 bathrooms, high pressed tin ceilings, a proper kitchen, lovely woodwork, big windows, a giant backyard with plenty of room for vegetables and a chicken coop. It's actually the perfect house for Andy. Maybe the taste is hereditary.
That's what I've probably told 20 or 30 people, and no one actually does believe that the great-great-grandchild now is living in the house when they hear the story, and no one can believe it.
I never met them and I never knew much about them until this, really, which has been kind of cool.
That story was by Sam Johncher with help from supervising producer Selena Shannon. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon, our Victorian State Coordinator is Beck Fari, our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie, Beth Gibson is our SYN Production Manager, Tegan Nichols compiles our show, and I'm Jess Hamilton. Our artwork is designed by Annie Hamilton and our theme music is composed by Shining Bird. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and also find our archives at allthebestradio.com. While you're at it, subscribe to our podcast on your favourite podcast app.